Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
These are both on.
Take it.
Can I see the program? Just wanted to be sure I'm talking on the right thing this morning. Today is Earth Day. Started in 1970 in the United States, Earth Day is now an international event and movement. So I'd like to talk about Earth Day for several reasons. I'm going to talk about it in a way that tries to link it to the talk that I gave last month in exploring the role of spiritual communities in social discourse about things like racism, poverty, homelessness, and environmental destruction. I'm going to let these folks settle in. If you heard that talk, you'll remember that it was motivated by a request to have the Zen Center support an organization to defeat a constitutional amendment that will define marriage as being only between a man and a woman. That request stimulated some thinking on my part. I also reflected in that talk on the work that the Zen Center is currently doing in service, in our relationship, our partnership with Joyce Food Shelf, and in our supporting meditation in jails and in detention centers. And I talked about how the Buddhist tradition, unlike Abrahamic traditions of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, doesn't seem to emphasize social justice. We emphasize compassion and wisdom, but not so much sitting down at the five and dime store in the South to protest racial discrimination or things like that. Churches and synagogues and other spiritual communities were critical to the civil rights movement in this country, and they are active today in this community in issues around racism, social justice, homelessness, and poverty. Now, there may be many reasons for Buddhism's lack of emphasis on social justice. Our emphasis on harmony and the middle way can make it difficult to take a stand. Karma has been used historically to justify inaction. Poor people are poor because of karma. There's nothing to do about it. And Zen has a long history of being a state religion and supporting subservience to the state in both China and Japan. And finally, the ideal of emptiness has been used historically to justify immoral acts, such as killing. If life and death are both empty, life and death are not different. And in Japan, emptiness has been used to justify death, justify killing. So there are potentially a lot of reasons why our tradition doesn't hold social justice highly. That was the last talk. But today is Earth Day. I received an email from a very, very good friend of mine after my last talk. She listened to it on the web. And she had a very strong reaction to it. That talk was not meant to depress people, nor is this one. But it is Earth Day. The first Earth Day was incredibly important to my formation as an adult. It changed the course of my life. In 1970, I organized the first Earth Day at my high school in Western Massachusetts. I still have a photograph from the Greenfield Gazette and Courier that shows me and my fellow organizers standing around a pile of steel cans. We were at a recycling drive, the first recycling drive Greenfield, Massachusetts had ever seen. And they were steel cans. We didn't have aluminum cans. I don't know if any of you old enough to remember those heavy steel cans with seams at the top and bottom that were doubly heavy. Plastic bottles had not been invented back then. So we need to imagine a couple of things. First, recycling was a brand new concept that ran counter to the exuberant post-World War II belief in endless growth. I actually took a lot of flack for organizing this recycling campaign. My mother and I went toe-to-toe over it, actually, quite a bit. She thought she had gotten to a point in her life, after a very hard life, where she did not have to concern herself with trash. Just flush it. Just get it out. Though I didn't know it at the time, this was the dawning of the great turning, which I'll talk about more in a moment. As I mentioned also in my last talk, I came to Buddhism out of a deep appreciation, a great appreciation and reverence for nature and the natural world. In some ways, that mystical appreciation for an inconceivably complex coevolution led me from the religion of my youth to Eastern thought. I grew up as a Christian, and specifically an Episcopalian. And that was a rather staid version of Christianity. The deep, deep appreciation for the beauty and complexity of the natural world led me eventually to conservation, which is an old term, environmentalism, deep ecology, and eventually Buddhism. I actually got my undergraduate degree in natural resources. I never practiced, but I got a degree anyway. Now, to that reverence for the natural world has been added a reverence and deep appreciation for the human manifestation and understanding exemplified by Shakyamuni Buddha and his followers through the millennia. So I come to this world of environmentalism and ecology over a period of 20 or 30 years. That included activism, and it's included education, and it's included my practice of Buddhism. If you haven't noticed, the world is in crisis. I personally believe the ecological crisis is the fundamentally critical challenge of our day. I also think it has two drivers: population growth and increased consumption, or standards of living. And both of those are rooted in the Four Noble Truths. They're both rooted in the first two of the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth is suffering exists. The second noble truth is that there is a cause of suffering, and that cause is craving, thirst, or greed. Population growth and consumption on a finite planet are manifestations of the human condition, as seen by the Buddha. Acquisitiveness and grasping, be it for progeny or material things. They create suffering. You might say this biological acquisitiveness is our karma, our collective karma, not just individual karma, our shared karma. Of course, karma by its very nature is shared. That's what I would like to talk about this morning. As I was walking over here, I heard ruby-crowned kinglets singing, and I noticed bellworts blossoming for the first time. Ruby-crowned kinglets are these tiny, tiny little mites of birds. Dart around in the trees very rapidly. And when they sing, you're just blown away because their voice is so robust. You're expecting a much bigger bird. So anyways, it's a beautiful morning. I'd like to start off with a concept or an idea called the Great Turning, which I mentioned earlier. It's a framework put forward by Joanna Macy. Joanna is a current day writer, teacher, Buddhist practitioner, mystic. And though I know Joanna, I haven't seen her for over a decade. I've been told, however, that she's pissed at the complacency of the Buddhist community in the face of our current situation. And Joanna is a matriarch. She is well into her 80s, and she's been active for many, many years. She calls this current time the Great Turning. Now, this has a Buddhist connotation to it. Mahayana Buddhism talks about the three turnings of the Dharma wheel. The first turning was Buddha's talks shortly after his enlightenment at Varanasi. And they were focused on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And he gave these talks to the people he had been wandering the countryside with for a decade. The second turning was at a place called Vulture Peak, and it's where he explained the concepts of emptiness and compassion. And the third turning took place took place all over India. And the third turning was the concept of Buddha nature. Now, I'm not going to go into those teachings, but that's the metaphor that Joanna is using. And there are other the three turnings of the Dharma wheel is used in other ways in Buddhism as well. But she's taken this concept and now applied it to describe the evolution of human consciousness. So the first turning, or the three turnings, are the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, and the current turning, the great turning, the environmental revolution. And we entered each of these revolutions with a certain consciousness and worldview and sense of who we are in the world. And we came out of those revolutions with an entirely different sense of who we were, who we are, as human beings. So think about it. Human societies came out of the agricultural revolution with a sense of rootedness that changed our sense of community and our relationship with the world and each other. No longer nomads and hunter-gatherers, we were settled in communities, tending and stewarding plots of land. The world became, using our new lenses, a different being. We created new social and civic institutions to guide our communal life. We valued cooperation and saving harvests and trading with people who used to be our enemies. That revolution took a couple of millennia. In this model, the Industrial Revolution is the second turning. And we as a species came out of that revolution with an entirely different worldview and sense of our place in the cosmos. We moved to large cities with complex built environments and consequently lost many of our daily routines that connected us to the natural world. We learned how to extract resources from the Earth's crust, and with new technologies for transportation, the world became much, much smaller. Our daily rhythms changed, as did our relationships with each other. We were now co-workers and employees rather than independent farmers and peasants, albeit probably tenant farmers and peasants. How we conceived ourselves and our place in the universe was quite different on each side of the Industrial Revolution. That revolution didn't take a couple of millennia. It took a century. And now Macy suggests that this third great turning of the wheel, the environmental revolution, is upon us. We're in the midst of a change that is similar to the previous two revolutions. We're moving towards a new sense of what it means to be human, our place in the world, what it means to be. Our values and institutions have to radically change. Maybe a small environmental footprint will be more important than having a good job or a solid career or a lot of money. Maybe having one kid or no kids will be of more value than procreating. On and on it goes. For billions of people across the globe, the world is changing in unpredictable and inconceivable ways. And Joanna suggests that this revolution doesn't have a couple of millennia. It doesn't have 100 years. It has maybe 20 years. And we're probably three-quarters of the way through it. And she's not convinced that we're going to turn the wheel in time. We've overfished our oceans. The climatological system may have already been sent into a pattern that can't be pulled back. Population growth is critical. When my father was born, there were fewer than 2 billion people on the Earth, and it took tens of thousands of years to get those 2 billion people. When I was born, there were 3 billion, less than 3 billion. Today, there are 7 billion, and in 2050, there will be 9 billion. If I'm lucky enough to live